Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, originally from New Kensington, Pennsylvania. He worked on P-38s in a Southern California factory before flying P-38s against the Luftwaffe in World War II. You can meet Jim and wish him a happy 100th birthday next month at the Central Coast Airfest in Santa Maria. Go to CentralCoastAirFest.com to get your tickets. I have that posted for you at HometownHeroesRadio.com as well. And Jim, a lot of people have that dream of becoming a fighter pilot, but there are a lot of hurdles you have to clear in the process of earning your wings and securing that kind of assignment. So I'm wondering if there were any bumps along that path for you.
I think I can honestly say I didn't breeze through it, certainly, but I went through pretty assured that I was going to get somewhere with it. I remember when we first took the test, we went out to the old, it was a big old type of resort kind of building on Grand Central Air Terminal where we took our exam. And I was a little concerned about that exam, but that worked out pretty much. I think they asked me, well, what preference did you have? Not that you're going to get it. They made that pretty clear, but I said, I want to fly P-38s, and I want to go to England. And I stuck with it the whole way through, and that's the way it ended up. And I think we started a few minutes ago backtracking on the P-38 being started. The design in 1937, the specifications that were laid out by the airport was for an interceptor aircraft. From a standing start to altitude to intercept bombers, attack the bombers, and go back and land and rearm. And that's the way the airplane was conceived. And it turned out a lot different than that. Again, being privy to a lot of friends, people that I knew and people that I tried to encourage being a friend of mine, why we kept up with the design of the 38. And remember, the 38 was the first airplane to go 400 miles an hour, and it was the first airplane to do a lot of things, including diving into what we call compressibility, because we didn't know what Mach numbers were. The Mustang came along, but that wasn't in my time period. So all through the cadet program, I was pretty much aligned to the 38 because it was the best fighter we had at the time. Mustang was a wonderful airplane. B-47 was a wonderful airplane, but they came along later.
I thought for a second you were going to dip your toe in the 47 versus 51 debate, but I won't make you do that. And I know you did get some time in 51s later. But tell me about the P-38, because you're one of the last people still living who flew the P-38 in combat. What was it like to fly that plane? What did you enjoy about it?
Well, the airplane would do what you ask it to do. When I went to Europe, we weren't assigned to a particular group or squadron. I had been shooting for the 8th Air Force because it's air-to-air combat, long missions, but that's where the action ends. Sure. That's what I thought anyway. They sent me to the 9th Air Force, and before D-Day, I found out that the 9th Air Force was doing a hell of a lot of fighting that nobody was paying much attention to because it was all down where they could shoot at you. But the 38, no matter where you took it, if altitude, it was a great performer. We could actually put 6 500-pound bombs on it. We could carry 2 2,000-pound bombs if we could get them. Regularly carried 1,000-pound bombs and get off a short runway. So for a fighter airplane, we had the performance. 38 would outclimb a 51, it'll outclimb a P-47. And even after they gave the P-47 guys big Hamilton standard props so it could climb anywhere. And we gave the Mustang to the Packard folks to put an engine in. A 38 just soldiered along pretty much with Allisons and turbochargers, and we never got the big Hamilton standard propellers. It's a good story there, being involved at Lockheed and working part-time down in the experimental hangar. They brought in one of the early P-38, they converted it to what they called a P-38K. They put a different Allison engine in it, and they slowed the prop down, and they put the big Hamilton Standard wide-blade, paddle-blade props on it. The airplane did so well, they actually built another one from scratch. The K was 40 miles an hour faster at altitude. It would climb to 45,000 feet. Outperformed the Mustang and the P-47 down at Eglin Field. War production board that required a different engine, different prop, the design change in the engine mount and the cowling. War production board would not shut down the line long enough to make those changes. We never got the K. Mustang got the Merlin engine. The P-47 got the big props. We could have sure used those.
I never heard that before. So basically what you're saying is for all the accomplishments of the P-38 and the Aces and the records, it could have been a much better airplane if they allowed those modifications to take hold?
Well, I wish in my final combat flight in the airplane, I wish I'd have had that extra few percent.
Yeah. And we're going to hear why you say that. But before we get to your last one, I'd love to hear about your first. So you guys were flying out of Andover, is that right?
Andover, England, 370th Fighter Group, 401st Squadron. Andover had been the old war college, RAF war college, so it was a big grass field, no runways. You could line up three or four or five or eight line abreast and all go at the same time. And when you did, you went downhill and then you went uphill and then you went downhill again and then you got off the ground. But it was great for Spitfires, but it wasn't all the best for the 38, although we had the tricycle gear, which made a heck of a big difference. My first mission, it was kind of a quiet mission. We took off. The minute you're airborne, you start picking up the buzz of the German radar, so they know you're there. They're tracking you, and we crossed the channel, and we intercepted some ground trucks. I was flying off of the squadron's operational officer, who was probably the most experienced combat pilot we had in the whole group. And so he went down and strafed the truck, and so I'm right on his wing, and I picked out my truck and strafed it and watched it fall apart. I had never fired all the guns on the P-38. Out over Catalina, I fired one gun out of the 150 out of the four and no cannon. And so when I pulled that damn trigger on that truck, I thought the airplane came to a sudden stop and was going to shake to pieces. That was probably the most exciting thing out of the whole mission.
Did that get your heart pumping a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We took some fire from the ground, so we came back around and made a strafing run on what we thought was the position that they were firing upon us. You just had to be careful.
Was there a moment, and maybe you understood it ahead of time, but I'm just wondering if there was a moment where the stakes of what you were doing became clear, where it became not just an idea, but a palpable thought that you could die doing this?
Well, yeah, I think you could figure that one out, although, you know, it usually happens to the other guy. It doesn't happen to you. I think that's the old thought. You know, I wanted to go to England because at the early part of the war, the English were taking a hell of a beating. And so I guess my thought was, well, let's get over there and help them out. When I arrived in England, just being associated with those people and being in London when they had a blackout, even before I joined the squadron, on the way to the squadron, we were experiencing some of that in London. And so you had the thought, well, I don't remember thinking of it as being a crusade, but I thought we were on somebody's list to accomplish something. So I never thought too much about, you know, dying. I think I was more worried about doing a good job. Some of my early missions, I could have used more experience than I had.
Well, sounds like I need to ask you about that. You said the Great Crusade. Of course, that's famously what Eisenhower said on D-Day as part of his speech to everybody. And I'm wondering, as I again try to imagine being you as this young fighter pilot, what you shared about your father, that his dream had been to be a fighter pilot. Were there times in the cockpit of that P-38 where you thought about your dad?
Oh, yes. Yep. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was 9 when he died, and I don't think there was ever a day I didn't think about him. But And you miss them, but my mother bent over backwards to raise me right, I guess. Sometimes I reneged on doing certain things because I didn't want to worry her, but she backed me all the way.
And you said something there a second ago. You said that on some of your early missions, you could have used a little more experience. So it sounds like you learned a few things the hard way.
Well, they didn't tell us too much about dive bombing. So I figured out that it's a little bit like witchcraft. You roll over and you try, well, I'll put this pipper on the target and then I'll pull through two radii and I'll release. And the damn bomb would drop someplace else. And so you learn by experience. We really didn't get much training here in the States. You got about 100 hours on the P-38. There's a rock on the north end of Catalina, and we used that as a target. And we dropped these little tiny bombs with a shotgun shell in them to make a puff of water. I don't think very many people hit the rock. Just had to build the experience of working it out for yourself. Sometimes you close your eyes on the dive so you don't see the plaque. That's one good advantage. And so you don't flinch. Bomb went where it was going to go. Actually, it took, you know, 8, 10, 12 missions to begin to feel like you were earning your pay.
And I think I read that at, you know, in some intense sequences or periods there, I mean, there were days where you were going up 3 or 4 times a day?
Yeah, that happened. Not all the time, but usually you split the squadron. We'd alternate the missions. And that was more for our ground crew. Those guys were working all night to get an airplane ready to get the bejesus shot out of it and bring it back. The scheduling worked out well. Every once in a while, we might get hit with 2 or 3 missions in one day. And I had some of my most exciting missions that very occurrence.
Well, I can't let that comment go by without asking you what made them so exciting.
Well, you know, we moved out of Andover and we went to A1. When we moved in there, now we're much closer to the lines and our missions were shorter. Within takeoff, 10 minutes later, you're over the enemy territory. So we were running missions that normally would have, flying the channel would be 2.5-3 hours. We're doing them in an hour. The one thing about the 9th Air Force that I learned very quickly was that we were in support of our ground troops. Mm-hmm. And so you, all of a sudden, you realize that, sure, it's nice to shoot down an enemy airplane or contest the air with an enemy fighter, but if you're helping those GIs down on the deck, very beneficial. And they certainly appreciated it, and even in the mistakes we made when we might strafe them, or we had a few occurrences like that where there was just no way you could identify your target. If they shot at us, why, we shot back. Sometimes they were shooting a little bit early. We felt that we were helping their efforts, and God knows they were doing a big job right from the day that morning of the 7th on through.
Well, and I've talked to some of those guys who've given, you know, an anonymous P-38 a lot of credit for saving their bacon on the ground when they were in some tough spots. You mentioned flak a moment ago. How consistent was that? I mean, is it the kind of thing where every time you fly, something's going to be coming up at you?
Well, yes. In the 9th Air Force, we got a lot of ground flak. And there was no way to fly over occupied France and Normandy without crossing over some type of flak equipment. So you never knew when you were going to get hit. Flak, they were pretty doggone accurate. I've been at a dive bombing run and had the 88s with big black puff. In the 88s, you think more being up with firing at the B-17s at 25,000. I've been in a dive bombing run and I'd have three bursts right off my wing. They weren't in line, but they were sure as hell on my altitude, and I'm diving.
Yeah.
So the Germans were very proficient with their anti-aircraft. The 40s and the 20mm, you could see those things coming at you, so you knew it. And then the 30 caliber, that's one reason I didn't care much for the Mustang early on. They could throw a rock at you, and with the right hit, you're done. But the 38, at least we had another engine to come home on.
If
flak was heavy. But when I talked to these Navy guys and Air Force guys that flew in Vietnam, they had flak like we never even dreamed of having. So I guess it's all in you doing what you do. But we were moving a heck of a lot slower.
What perspective we're picking up today from P-38 pilot Jim Kunkel, but we haven't yet explored the mission that earned him the Distinguished Service Cross. We might end up needing another episode to squeeze all of that in. I'm going to keep mentioning this because I really hope you take this suggestion to heart. The Central Coast Air Fest is October 15th and 16th in Santa Maria, California. If you're listening on our affiliate, KSMA in Santa Maria, I'm sure you already know all about the historic aircraft that are going to be coming. But this history-making World War II pilot is going to be there too, and he turns 100 during the air show. Go to centralcoastairfest.com to get your tickets and make sure to find Jim when you go. I have that information linked for you as well at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll have more with this amazingly sharp and resilient survivor when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.